Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the damage done to the NATO mission in Afghanistan by the US Army Staff Sergeant who murdered 16 Afghan civilians, including 9 children asleep in their beds. A former Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of manpower, Lawrence Korb, joins us to discuss the stress of multiple deployments on service personnel and the impact this tragedy may have on the planned US withdrawal. Then we will speak with Kim Barker, the author of The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The former South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, she is now the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we will discuss the vexed and tragic relationship between America and Afghanistan, and at a time of acrimony and distrust, Kim Barker's affection for the Afghan people, their culture, and their country. Then finally, we'll speak with Tom Jensen, the director of Public Policy Polling, who have just released a poll on the likely outcome of tomorrow's Republican primary elections in Mississippi and Alabama, where Santorum and Gingrich are splitting the conservative vote to the extent that Romney may eke out a narrow victory in one or both states. And just before we begin, I'd like to invite you again to the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm moderating this Thursday, March the 15th at 7 p.m., buying votes. We're going to talk about how the super PACs are overwhelming our already money-driven election with Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University and the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Again, this coming Thursday, March the 15th at 7 p.m. Hope you can join me. Joining us now is Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information, and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
And clearly the murder of 16 Afghan civilians, 9 children who were asleep in their bed, is a terrible setback in terms of what's already a difficult relationship with Afghanistan, given the deadline to pull out. Do you think that this incident and the previous burning of the Qurans is going to accelerate the pullout date?
Well, I think it not only will accelerate the pullout date in terms of getting the majority of the troops out, but it'll make it very difficult to us to leave troops in there after the 2014 deadline, because we're negotiating with the Afghans right now, and they've insisted that with the remaining troops, probably special forces, no more night raids without their permission. And we're saying, no, we want to do that. Given this incident, it's going to be very hard for them to allow us to go on raids that they don't know about.
And do you think that this is a product of this long war, the longest war in American history? My understanding from anecdotal information from soldiers and officers I've talked to is that there's a kind of smoldering anger amongst U.S. soldiers in the sense that they don't feel the people in Afghanistan are grateful for the sacrifices they're making. And on the other hand, you get the impression that the Afghans see us not as liberators, but as occupiers.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that the war has gone on so long and the troops are frustrated. And also the troops have had tremendous pressure on them. This young man, whose name we don't know, is a staff sergeant. He is on his fourth tour in 11 years in the service. According to what you're supposed to do to make sure that the troops' mental health is guarded, you should have at least 2 years in between each deployment. This young man obviously is not. There's 3 tours in Iraq, 1 in Afghanistan, and then seeing some of his fellow soldiers killed by Afghans that they were theoretically training to protect the population may have just caused him to snap. The base he comes from, Fort Lewis out there, they've had a record number of suicides last year and people with mental problems. You've had soldiers on those bases after coming back killing civilians, killing each other.
Fill us in a little more, if you can, on what you just told us about the incident that this soldier may have witnessed where U.S. trainers were killed by their Afghan students, if you will.
Well, what we've seen is that you've had soldiers who we've trained were actually, Taliban people that we didn't know about. They got into the Afghan security forces. They turned on not just Americans, but they killed British people. You've had Americans killed working in the embassies, or I should say the ministries of Afghanistan as well. So over the last month, you've had probably about a dozen of the Allied troops killed by the people they were supposed to be training to carry out the missions.
Well, there are a lot of media reports saying that this soldier is a member of the 2nd, 3rd Infantry, 3rd Striker Brigade combat team, which, of course, is based in Washington State at Fort Lewis. But this is the same base that was home to the so-called kill team, which was this rogue unit led by Sergeant Calvin Gibbs that kept all those grisly souvenirs of Afghans that they'd murdered.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Back in 2010, they were part of what they called the kill squad, and four of them have actually been convicted. You also had a soldier there at Fort Lewis that is believed to have shot a Washington Park Ranger to death on New Year's Day. And 12 soldiers on the base have committed suicide in 2010, and we don't know what the number is for 2011 yet either.
Well, you used to be in charge of manpower. I mean, what kind of screening do we have? What kind of follow-on? You were saying earlier that this particular sergeant, and nobody's condoning in any way what he did, but we're trying to understand why he did it. You're saying that he's had multiple deployments without the necessary break going back home. I take it he's also a father of a two-year-old, isn't he?
Right. He's a father. And when you mentioned I was there in the manpower area, what we instilled, the policy was that for every year you spend in a combat zone, at least 2 years at home. Well, obviously, if he's been in the service 11 years and this is his fourth deployment, there's no way he's had the 2 years in between deployments. And that enables you to get your life back together again and then be ready to go back. And it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, he was cleared to go back, into Afghanistan last December. And this is, not the first incident. We've had, similar incidents in Iraq where the troops have snapped and done things that they should not. And remember, and I don't know, who this person is, we relaxed our standards quite a bit as the wars in Iraq particularly became unpopular from 2003 to, 2008. And whether this person should have been taken in, whether he should have been allowed to stay in, is another question we're going to have to take a look at.
And of course, there was the massacre that the Marines took place in, which we're familiar with out here because we're close to Camp Pendleton.
Place in Haditha.
Haditha, right? Yes.
Right, and you just had the other situation there where the Marines were urinating on the corpses of a dead Afghan.
So, does this tell us anything about a lack of training, Lawrence Corp? Since you were in charge of manpower, you would think. I understand there have been what they loosely refer to as sensitivity training, but clearly that didn't work in the case of the Quran. There are some indications. There's a group you may well be familiar with, Lawrence Korb, who have argued for some time that there's too much Christian proselytizing within the ranks. Would that be an explanation for the lack of sensitivity, for example, to the Quran burning?
Well, I think the problem is these are young men and women who really have not had the training to understand the culture that they've been thrown into. And, for many people, Christians and Jewish people, the Bible is holy, but it's not the same as the Quran. That's much more important to Muslims than say the Bible would be to Christians or Jewish people. And I think the fact of the matter is that these people are thrown into an environment in which it's very hard for them to comprehend. And given the fact that they come in, they get, training in combat skills and then get sent over. They have a little bit of training for the culture, but it's really not. You can't understand the culture of a country like Afghanistan, in a matter of months. You've got scholars who take years to understand it.
But we're talking about an American culture here, Lawrence Korb, in which good percentage, at least in Mississippi, and according to recent polls about the forthcoming election there tomorrow, 40% of Mississippi Republican voters believe that Obama is a Muslim. Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, made that inference recently. We already have in this country, I think, tremendous bigotry and ignorance about religion. And, well, and you'd think that given that baseline, there'd be some fairly aggressive training going on about how important the Quran and Islam is to these people that you're supposed to be helping.
Yes, you would hope so. But again, remember that you've got people in this country, unfortunately, talk about the enemy is Islam, not Al-Qaeda. And you've heard terms like Islamofascism that, you know, people use. And these young people can be susceptible to it. In my view, the country is at fault here, not the young people we throw into these environments without enough time in between deployments. Our real failure was our volunteer military was not constructed to fight long wars. We should have activated the selective service system. This would have given us more time to train the people to undertake these missions, because they're not being asked just to do combat missions. They're asked to do, you know, counterinsurgency and nation building, and that's much more complex than just, you know, regular combat missions.
And as you mentioned earlier, during Iraq, when there was a manpower shortage, they reduced the standards down right to, was it Category 4?
Well, it's not only Category 4, but they were giving moral waivers. There's a young man in jail now in Kentucky. His name is Private Stephen Green, who was a high school dropout, had, you know, criminal convictions and a personality problem. They took him in, and when this kid got over to Iraq, he raped a young girl and killed the family. And that's the type of thing, you know, that you've had. And again, even people who don't have these particular, you know, mental situations where they come in with these back-to-back deployments and not enough time to stay home, get their lives back together, get the treatment that they need, thrust back in, it's no wonder that they break sometimes.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and also a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Lawrence Korb, most of the Afghan experts, and you mentioned that they're few and far between, very few, I happen to know Chris Fair very well, who speaks all the languages, and I think is one of the best analysts there. She and many others, Marvin Weinbaum and others, tell me, because I try and stay in touch with this issue, pretty much agree that there's going to be a civil war when we pull out. Is that your reading?
Well, it really depends upon whether you can get a government in Kabul that is seen as not corrupt and has the interests of the people at heart. And that's something that no matter how long we stay, you know, we really can't change. And I think, you know, people like Christine and Marvin are correct that if they don't, then obviously the Taliban will try and come back. And the real question is, will they take Al-Qaeda back? Will the Taliban do the horrible things that they did when they were in power the last time? Will they destabilize the region? And these are issues that we've got to work on, because we're on our way out. The question is really how quickly, and does this event make it, accelerate our timetable?
Well, clearly our relations with Pakistan are central to this issue. And my understanding is that since the bombing of the Afghan border post that resulted in the death of 24 Pakistani soldiers, the access for supplies through Pakistan and through the Khyber Pass are still closed. What's the update on that?
Well, basically, they're going to let some come through, but they're going to raise the price here. But you're right, they did close it for a while, and we had to get the supplies in coming through Russia and their former republics to get it in there, which, of course, increased the cost exponentially. I mean, it cost, you know, over $1 million for every man or woman you have on the ground by the time you count all what's necessary to get them the supplies.
And we got 78,000 on the ground, is that right?
That's what, right now. Well, basically, we have close to 100,000. We're going to be taking some out this year. The so-called surge, 30-some-odd thousand, which will get us to 68,000 by the end of 2012, unless we accelerate it.
So you got 100,000 at a million ahead.
That's correct, and that's why if you look at the what they call the, you know, supplemental or the OCO, Overseas Contingency Operation budget this year, you know, the vast majority, it's $100 million to, you know, Afghanistan. Iraq has obviously come down quite substantially because we're, you know, all of our military is out.
So what's your understanding of where we stand in terms of a dialogue or liaison with the Pakistan military, in particular the ISI? Obviously, there's been a very contentious relationship since bin Laden was killed right there next to the military academy. And there's a new head of ISI who's apparently sort of media savvy, but that's about all I've heard about him. One of the things that I find extraordinary is that there's so much anti-Americanism in Pakistan, and the military are clearly supporting Imran Khan, the cricket player, who's very popular and who's running on a stridently anti-American ticket. I'm wondering if the Pakistani military leadership are so intensely anti-American that they can't sort of see the forest for the trees, to the extent that if the Taliban take over in Afghanistan, which most people predict would be the case, that would then become a pretty dangerous possibility that the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban can get together and overwhelm the Pakistan state.
Well, I don't think they can do that, but I think the real danger is, will the Pakistanis work with us to get the Taliban to come to the table to make some sort of power sharing arrangement? But I think you're quite right. I mean, if it were up to me, I wouldn't give the Pakistan military any aid. I'd give aid to the people of Pakistan because they don't like us, and basically the military is able to play on that. And by saying, well, we'll give you aid if you fight, they'll do what they need to do. When I was in Pakistan and the Taliban kind of broke out of the Northwest Territories and came down toward Islamabad, boy, the military went after them then. So they'll fight to maintain the state, but they have their Taliban. They'd like to see them in Afghanistan to make sure India doesn't have any influence there.
Well, I would use the sort of the guard dog analogy, you know, that you have a pit bull that you train to be aggressive, and then one day it takes over the entire house and you become a prisoner.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think that's an interesting analogy, and I think you certainly have to be careful, but I think they certainly are aware of that. But you're right. I mean, you play with fire, you can get burnt, but they're trying to use the so-called Haqqani network, which is kind of the Pakistan Taliban, you know, for their own aims. The real issue is, are they going to be working with, you know, us in the negotiations in Qatar to come to some sort of, you know, peaceful arrangement there? And the other country we have to work with to ever get this Afghan situation under control is Iran. Iran has an influence. The Northern Alliance people were, you know, their proteges that they kept to keep the Taliban from taking control over the whole country.
Well, there are arguments, though, that the social fabric of Afghanistan has been so torn that it's difficult to imagine that you could reconstruct a kind of Northern Alliance, which is the status quo ante before the U.S. Got involved after 9/11. And, you know, they were fighting a civil war there for some time. Mm-hmm. And my understanding the Pakistani, the really good Pakistani scholar, I wish I could think of his name, Rashid, I think it is. Do you know who I'm talking
about? Ahmad Rashid,
right. Let me repeat that. The Pakistani analyst Ahmad Rashid said that the social fabric of Afghanistan has been torn irreparably. So is there the assumption that Iran has influence may not be it may be the case in the area around what's the name of their capital there? In the Shia area of Afghanistan. But the idea that the Shia and the Uzbeks the Tajiks could get together again, apparently is questionable.
Well, I think you're right, but they do. You're quite right. But I mean, the solution to making sure Afghanistan doesn't destabilize the region is have to involve all of the neighboring countries. And you're right. The challenge for us is it'd be great if we could put Afghanistan society back together again. But the real thing is, does it threaten the region? Does it become a haven for al-Qaeda? I was in Afghanistan with Ahmad Rashid just about a year ago at this time. And, you know, he knew Karzai, and we met with a lot of the, you know, people there. And our report that we put out was basically, you've got to begin negotiating because you can't win this thing. And right now, as long as we keep forces there, the Taliban can't win either. So let's negotiate some sort of, you know, solution and then get the neighbors involved.
Well, but if you go back to when we invaded, my understanding is that amongst the Afghans, not just the elite in Kabul, but in throughout the country, there was this sense of relief that the Taliban had gone. And there was this belief that, you know, the Americans, after all, the people who put a man on the moon, they can surely help us. And it looks as though the Bush administration had absolutely no interest in doing much there, particularly in what, and they had such disdain for nation building. There were years went by when nothing happened. And now we see this Wall Street Journal did a recent article that in 2011, something like $5 billion in cash have very casually gone through the airport at Kabul on the way to banks in the Gulf. It looks as though the elite are stealing all of the aid money that we're giving that country, and that the people haven't really got much to show for the, what's it going to be, a bill of about $1 trillion at the end of the day?
Right. That's right. There's no doubt about the fact that, you know, basically, when we drove the Taliban out and everything, we did not recognize, you know, what needed to be done. And the Bush administration shifted its attention to Iraq before the job was done. This allowed, of course, the Taliban to come back in. And then, of course, Obama was handed this mess, and he was trying to fix it. The real question is it too late to get it back together again? Because you're quite right. I mean, you have so much corruption. That's why the people don't trust the government and don't want to rally around. They also think, you know, when we were there, and again, when I was there with Ahmad Rashid, we met with Ismail Khan, who's the Lion of Herat. And he said to us, he said, you come in here in 2001, you had 850 people, you drove the Taliban out. Now you got 100,000, you can't win. What's the problem? You know, I mean, we just let the thing, we missed the golden moment.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Korb, given what we're talking about, for the average U.S. soldier, they must wonder why we're here. If we're wondering why we're here, they're there losing their buddies and feeling the anger of the local people that they're supposed to be helping, and yet there doesn't seem to be any gratitude. And on the other hand, from the Afghans' point of view, the U.S. soldiers haven't helped them, and they're looking more and more like occupiers. And now that this massacre has taken place, it's even worse. What's your sense, having been in charge of manpower, of the real nature of the morale there? Because I have a feeling that most of our soldiers want to get the hell out of there.
Well, you're quite right. It's very interesting. You know which Republican candidate gets the most contributions from active duty military people? Ron Paul.
And he's steadfastly saying we should get out.
He wants to get out. You're right, because they see no end in sight. And it's over and over again, back, and, you know, and it doesn't seem to be, you know, any end game. And they see their, you know, fellow soldiers and Marines dying, and they wonder, well, you know, what's it all about? And it's not just the ones who are dying, the ones who are wounded. I mean, it used to be, you know, if every three people wounded, one died. Now it's for every 15 wounded, only one dies. So in addition to the, you know, the people who die, you got these, you know, people who are going to be wounded for the and suffer the consequences for the rest of their lives.
Well, Lawrence Gorb, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Gorb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of The Taliban Shuffle.
Parting of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triumph, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Kim Barker, who was for almost 5 years the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, directing coverage of Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, where she covered the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan and corruption in Afghanistan. She is now the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a general assignment reporter at ProPublica, working on enterprise and investigative stories. Her new book out this month is The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Barker.
Thanks for having me.
And your book is often wry and funny, and there's not a lot of humor to be gained from the moment. It does seem that the U.S. and Afghanistan have had such a star-crossed relationship, given that when the U.S. went in there after 9/11 and quickly eliminated the very few Americans involved, as a matter of fact, quickly eliminated the Taliban. I believe there was an expectation on the part of most Afghans that, oh, these are the people who put the man on the moon. They're going to fix our broken country. And nothing happened. And now things have just gotten worse and worse. And $1 trillion later, there's not much to show for it but mutual animosity.
Yeah, I know. It's actually, as somebody who's watched it for so long, it's very disheartening and sad to see what's happening there. And I did try to tell in my book, it's not like laugh out loud, funny, ha-ha. It's more dark humor and absurdist than anything else, because I had just started seeing these things happen and the same mistakes being repeated by the West there and the same mistakes being repeated by the Afghan and Pakistani leadership. The latest news is it's heartbreaking. I mean, I just know exactly what's going to happen and the fallout of what this is going to be.
Well, just walk us through that then, if you will.
Not going to be anything like the Quran burnings. The fallout from the Quran burnings is always going to be worse. Any time that you insult Islam or the Prophet, you're going to have more of a reaction in Afghanistan and Pakistan than you do with incidents like this. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be fallout from this, but I don't think you're going to see the same level of riots. I think you're going to more see perhaps targeted killings, looking at some sort of revenge against American troops. But I don't think you're going to see the same level of rallies. It doesn't really matter. It just, to me, just is another indication of where the relationship is at this point and how difficult it's going to be to achieve what the U.S. says its goals are before 2014.
Well, you have a chapter in your new book, Kim Barker, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Chapter 3, American Idiot. And it does seem that it's pretty hard to comprehend how, after what had happened with earlier incidents involving the Quran burning, particularly that pastor down in Florida, that U.S. troops could be that unconscious to go ahead and do this and not recognize the dire consequences.
The ramifications. I think it has to do with a general still to this day, more than 10 years on, lack of understanding about the culture and how religion and how Islam plays into the culture in Afghanistan and Pakistan and also throughout the Islamic world. I mean, it is just a book you cannot burn. There's very strict ways you've got to deal with old Qurans. When you read through the explanation of what happened, particularly the explanations in the New York Times, it does seem like this was just a mistake. It was just a bad mistake. But the fact that there was nobody that caught it before it happened, given how many times this seems to have happened in the past, is just, it's incredibly unfortunate.
Well, I'm just reminded of the fact that in tomorrow's election in Mississippi and Alabama, apparently a recent poll, we're going to be speaking with the pollster in a minute, indicates that over 40% of the electorate down there believe that Obama's a Muslim. So we have a kind of, I think as a culture, we have a kind of ignorance problem, don't we?
I can't really say whether as a culture we have an ignorance problem, and it's very difficult for me to speak to polls I haven't seen. I mean, I can talk about polls that I've seen in the past talking about, you know, how folks did think that Saddam Hussein in Iraq was somehow involved with the 9/11 attacks, and that that was the reason that the U.S. had gone in there. And that is a problem. It's always a problem when folks aren't actually paying attention to the news, but are instead just paying attention to what people regurgitate is the news. In other words, just sort of following the folks that, pairing the folks that say what they already believe. And that, as much as anything, is an indictment of what's happened to the news industry in America, and the fact that there is this fragmentation, and in terms of covering foreign news and covering these stories, you just don't have nearly as many people doing it as you did in the past.
So it's both a consequence of the news bureaus being cut and general society.
Just not paying, there's also, I think, a tendency to believe these conspiracies. It's interesting you bring up the Obama situation. As part of my reporting for the Chicago Tribune, I actually did go to Indonesia and take a look at his time there, and pulled his original school records, including the form that did initially list him as being enrolled in a Catholic school as a Muslim. But and that is used a lot of times as this is somehow proof that he was a Muslim growing up. But it doesn't get to the fact that in Indonesia at that particular time, most any kid would be listed as a Muslim despite his actual religion, just because that is the majority religion there. And the fact that the family that that Obama was living with at the time, his stepfather Lolo Satoro and his mother, did not identify themselves as Muslims.
And he did go to a Catholic school, which is not exactly common.
Catholic schools in large many parts of the world are considered to be where you can get a good education. He went to a Catholic school for, I believe it was 3 years, and a public school for a little bit more than a year in Indonesia.
And most of the experts that I talked to who, some of whom speak the actual languages and spend time there, not too many have those qualifications, frankly. They're pretty much predicting a kind of a civil war when the U.S. pulls out. And if anything, this incident that just took place might well accelerate that. What do you think is the understanding in Pakistan, where anti-Americanism is pretty virulent and the cricket player is running on an anti-American ticket, and he's pretty much backed by the military there, and I don't know that we're even speaking with their military, and they're still closed off the supply routes following the killing of the Pakistani soldiers on the border.
There's a new leader of the ISI,
right, yes. Yeah.
Pakistan's main intelligence service. And he seems, at least from what I've read, to have more friendly relations with the U.S., and I know that the U.S. and the ISI are trying to work things out. But you're right. I mean, relations between Pakistan and America really, you can find incidents probably in the past that they were this bad, but I'm hard-pressed to think of any at this particular moment. what's going to happen in Afghanistan and Pakistan. As long as the West is talking about pulling out in 2014, the major fear over there, especially for Afghans, is that there is going to be civil war. It's not going to be the Taliban marching back in. It's not going to be some sort of coalition government that's going to be able to successfully pull off a transition. The different groups and the different warlords are going to factionalize yet again and start fighting for who will control it. And that some group will eventually have to broker the peace, such as what happened in the 90s, and that group, of course, was the Taliban. I think Pakistan's interest in this is to try to come up with a government and support a government in Afghanistan that is seen as pro-Pakistan and not as pro-India, and they will do what it takes to get that particular government in place. And as far as Imran Khan, the cricket player you mentioned, being, you know, a functionary of the military, I mean, maybe, but there are plenty of other functionaries of the military there. It's difficult to say that he is, you know, particularly their guy.
Well,
I've heard other people say that.
That's true. I mean, I suppose the one thing you can say about the Pakistan military is that it's not so much a country with an army, but an army with a country.
Well, and that's exactly it. Whoever's going to run things and whoever's going to win the election, civilian-wise, it's pretty much the army and the ISI that are going to be pulling strings behind the scenes. I mean, you're seeing that right now. You know, the good things about this particular civilian government, it's certainly been able to hold on much longer than anybody had initially predicted. But it's the same sort of problems with it being a weak government, with it having, you know, no sense of institution, and its main goal seems to be to hold on to power rather than to you know, make any actual changes in the country.
But when you say, Kim Barker, that Pakistan would like a compliant government there, the one that...
They would like a pro-Pakistan
government. Well, wouldn't that be a Taliban government?
Well, sure. I mean, that it's been that in the past. And that is something that people, you know, an expert suggests, is that they would want to have something like the Taliban again. And I guess it's really a question if the Taliban, if it were to come back, could ever be like it was in the past, if it could successfully close off a country that's been opened up to the world. I mean, can you really kick the internet out of Afghanistan altogether? Can you really kick TV at this point out of Afghanistan altogether? In a country, you know, where you've got, you know, something like 70% of folks there under age 30, and where you've got a lot of young folks in the city who have really sort of embraced the whole idea of moving forward and moving past war, are they going to accept going backwards into something like the Taliban regime of the 90s? It's better to ask Afghans that than to ask me, but the folks I know would say that would be very difficult to go back.
Well, but the question arises, surely, Kim Barker, about how that would then impact Pakistan if they have a compliant government there, but that is more radical than their own, and they already have a problem with the so-called Pakistan Taliban. Isn't that a possible scenario, like having a guard dog that takes over the whole house?
It's one possible scenario. I don't think it's the most likely scenario. You know, as you've mentioned, there is the Pakistan Taliban that has been a problem for the military, and certainly attack the military. Kind of an example that you could say of like creating a Frankenstein-like creature that turns back on you. But I can't see an Afghan government that was run by that version of the Taliban coming back on Pakistan, because if the scenario you're playing out were to happen, it would involve Pakistan being somehow involved in helping them stabilize the country.
Well,
you
the last
can't say for sure that that's no. what's going to happen. Either.
Sure. Well, the last time the only support that the Afghan Taliban had was from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, assuming that they would be a pariah state as they were before. It's difficult to see them being that strong, but I just wondered how resilient the state apparatus is in Pakistan, given the weakness of the government and the virulence of the anti-Americanism. Or do you think that once the American footprint goes away, the anti-Americanism will die down?
Well, yeah, I think it'll certainly diminish and it'll go down a bit. There's been a history of, you know, sort of upswings and downswings in how Pakistan and Pakistanis feel about Americans and the American government. But as far as the state being weak, it depends on how you define the state. If you define it as a civilian government, you know, yes, you can definitely say that. But if you define it as, you know, the entity that is running the country, which is essentially the military and its associated ISI groups, that's very strong. It's a very strong institution to the detriment of civil society and you know, other institutions that haven't really had a chance to develop yet.
So you don't share that pervasive idea that Pakistan could dissolve or at least its nuclear arsenal could...
I don't think that's a very pervasive idea. I think, that, I mean, at least from talking to folks, that's a fear.
Right. Pervasive fear then, yeah.
Yeah, most folks, most experts I know tend to feel like it's probably like Pakistan will simply muddle along, as it's always muddled along, you know, in this sort of gray area between state and failed state,
right,
where the military is pulling the strings.
Right, between a military government and a civilian kleptocracy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the people there. Well, I do think a large majority of them don't like the direction, the sort of like the military coming in and then back and forth between a military government and some sort of civilian facsimile.
Well, but there are some sobering facts here that Pakistan is, I believe, the world's fastest growing nuclear arsenal. They've surpassed numerically the French. Probably equal to the British now. One does wonder why they need such a growing nuclear arsenal.
Well, I think if you were to ask Pakistanis, it's all about India, and it goes to the whole, you know, the whole what's happening in Afghanistan right now, which has a lot more to do with Pakistan's relationship with India than it necessarily does with 9/11 or anything that we think it has to do with.
Well, just in closing, Kim Barker, given the kind of poisonous nature of the current situation with this massacre of 16 civilians, 9 children asleep in their beds, on top of an already strained relationship where the average Afghan may have seen Americans as liberators in the first place, but now apparently see them as occupiers, and probably the average American soldier sees them as ungrateful people that we're making sacrifices for, and more often than not, NATO military trainers are being shot in the back by the people that they train. So there's an awful lot to suggest, you know, a star-crossed relationship, shall we say. But what is it about, and it's certainly reflected in your book, The Taliban Shuffle, what is it about the Afghans that you find appealing, given the negativity of the moment?
Geez, you know, it was one of those countries, and I think a lot of journalists will say this, where you go there and it just really gets under your skin, the people get under your skin, and I mean in a good way, not a bad way. Just the whole idea that, I don't know if I've ever been to a country that feels as foreign and as different in some ways, and then reminded me in other ways of where I grew up, Montana, you know, a place with guys with beards and guns and pickup trucks who don't like the government, plus the mountains, which is, of course, very similar to Afghanistan. But folks I met there, I mean, immediately you're meeting people and they're telling you their biggest secrets and their hopes and their dreams, and they had so many hopes and dreams in the beginning, and would invite you into their homes. Just this real naked optimism and this real just sort of outreach of friendship. And I've never had hospitality like that. I think but the place is beautiful. Many of the people were just so welcoming. And it's just incredibly sad to me and difficult to see how things are going. And in some ways I wrote the book, although it is darkly comic, as some sort of way to try to get people to pay attention to everything that had happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to try to see, you know, folks there as humans first, more than just sort of like this whole idea of the other.
Well, also there's this belief, you know, and an expectation that women are going to suffer if the Taliban take over. It doesn't sound, it sounds like the Pashtunwali hospitality was extended to you. It doesn't sound in any ways that, well, maybe in some ways, as a woman there, you didn't have such a bad time.
Well, yeah, and that's in large part because I was a foreign woman. and I was a guest in the country, you know. So I didn't get treated like I was a local woman. I didn't get treated like I was a foreign man. It was almost as if I was some sort of like a third sex, you know, like that had equal access to both the women and the men.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. So do you think then, just in closing, that if the inevitable pullout is accelerated one way or the other, we're getting out, what's your final thoughts on that matter? I know we've talked about how the conventional wisdom is that there'll be a civil war. Is there any more optimistic possibility?
No. I mean, I really wish there was something I felt optimistic about. But, I mean, my feeling is if we're going to stay on this current path that we're on, and I see no indication that we're not going to stay on that path, that you've essentially told that entire region this is the end date. And it's very difficult to tell a nation of fence-sitters when you're talking about leaving at that particular time to then back you until then. I think it's more likely, just looking at human nature and looking at folks who have been at war, you know, for so long, that they're going to pick and they're going to side with not necessarily who they want to lead the country, but who they think will end up leading the country, which is a very different thing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Kim Barker.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Kim Barker, who was for almost 5 years the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, directing coverage of Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, where she covered the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan and corruption in Afghanistan. She is now the Edwin R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a General Assignment Reporter at ProPublica, working on enterprise and investigative stories. Her new book, just out, is The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the pollster who did the latest polls in Mississippi and Alabama. Don't want to be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. Hey, can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal mind, f*** America.
Like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Jensen, who's the Director of Public Policy Polling. And you've just done a poll in Alabama and Mississippi, two states coming up in tomorrow's primary. It looks like it's going to be a very close race, according to your polling. Basically, the three candidates, Gingrich, Romney, and Santorum, neck to neck in both cases, with Newt Gingrich a slight lead, Mitt Romney in second, and Rick Santorum in third. I suppose the first thing that's pretty obvious here, surely, Tom, is how much Gingrich and Santorum are splitting the conservative vote.
Absolutely. Gingrich and Santorum are both a lot more popular than Romney in Alabama and Mississippi. But when you look at voters describing themselves as very conservative, there's only a 3-point difference between Gingrich and Santorum in Mississippi, only a 6-point difference between the two of them in Alabama. So even though Republican voters in these states don't like Mitt Romney that much, and even though he does very poorly with these conservative voters, there's enough of a split between Santorum and Gingrich that when you add in Romney's support with moderates, he has a real chance to win.
And what explains the slight lead that Gingrich has over Santorum? Could it be attributed to the fact that Gingrich is a southerner and Santorum is a northerner? What's your, is there any information on that?
Yeah, Gingrich is definitely seen much more as a southern candidate, and he's persistently polled better than Santorum in the South, I think because of that connection that voters feel with him. And one group that Gingrich is breaking out from the pack a little bit with in these southern states is Tea Party voters. Gingrich is stronger than Santorum with Tea Party voters, which hasn't necessarily been the case in other parts of the country.
So a lot of the details in your poll are making national headlines here. Tom Jensen, again, the director of public policy polling. The part of the poll that refers to question number 22. Do you think Barack Obama is a Christian or a Muslim, or are you not sure? In Alabama, the survey finds that only 14% consider Obama a Christian, while 45% said he is a Muslim and 41% answered that they were not sure. And in Mississippi, with the same question asked, 12% said Obama was a Christian, 52% classified him as Muslim, and 36% fell in the not sure category. What are we to make of this? It's obviously, as I mentioned, it's getting national headlines.
Yeah, these concerns about Obama's identity among Republican voters really aren't going away. In addition to these findings about his religion in Alabama and Mississippi, last week in the Super Tuesday states, Ohio, Georgia, and Tennessee, we found that less than half of Republican voters thought Barack Obama was born in the United States, that despite the release of his birth certificate, this birther phenomenon is still very strong. And I think these numbers on his religion in the South sort of just reinforce this feeling among Republican voters still, with all the sort of correct information out there. They just don't like Obama, and they're just going to refuse to accept that he's a Christian and refuse to accept that he's a legitimate U.S. citizen.
Well, there was I don't know whether you saw the Game Change movie on HBO about the McCain-Palin campaign. And towards the end there, Senator McCain, this happened in real life and in the movie, was asked by a supporter in a live exchange, you know, that I can't vote for this other guy because he's a Muslim. And McCain said, no, he's a good guy, he's a Christian, and, you know, we shouldn't talk about that kind of stuff. That happened back in 2008. It's not going away. Is there any evidence that Santorum's having fueled it by questioning Obama's theology, saying it's a theology not based on the Bible, or perhaps the evangelist Franklin Graham suggesting that Obama is a Muslim? Any evidence to attribute this phenomenon, Tom?
I'm not sure why it's so strong right now. One thing that's interesting to note in these Mississippi and Alabama numbers is that Newt Gingrich is actually the candidate winning among voters who think that Barack Obama is a Muslim. So even though Santorum has maybe been a little bit more outspoken sort of going down this route, these voters who have these feelings that Obama's not a Christian are actually gravitating towards Gingrich.
Well, one of the other aspects of the poll that's interesting, and it to some extent contradictory perhaps, is question 24. Do you think that interracial marriage should be legal or illegal? And a majority of 67% say legal to 21% illegal. That's in, I think, Alabama, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So,
but then in Mississippi, only 54% think it should be legal and 29% believe it should be illegal. So I think 54% sounds to me like a pretty low number for 2012.
Well, that's true. I was about to take heart with the notion that up to 67% at least have gotten over that pillar of the Jim Crow era, but you're quite correct in suggesting that news out of Mississippi is not so good. It's obviously going to be, of all of the races, this would be the tightest. Do you think that super PACs are playing a role in this? I mean, what's the media landscape like down there in terms of who is bombarding the airwaves with what?
Well, I think that Romney has definitely been winning the media war, and that's a big part of why he's so competitive in these races. Santorum and Gingrich obviously start out with more goodwill than Romney does in these states, but they just don't have the resources that he does. And it's interesting to see how much time Romney's been focusing on Alabama and Mississippi. Clearly, he really does feel that he can win these states. And for the most part, looking back on the contests we've had so far, if Romney thought he could win a state, with the exception of maybe South Carolina, he did end up winning it. So it's going to be interesting to see if he can pull off this duo of upsets tomorrow. I think if he does, this contest may wrap up sooner than later.
Well, again, though, it's so obvious, isn't it, Tom Jenkins, again, the director of public policy polling. It's so obvious that Gingrich and Santorum are splitting the conservative vote. Is there any talk in these two races in Alabama and Mississippi of the obvious? I mean, are they being asked by local media? You know, how come you guys are splitting the vote?
Yeah, I mean, we asked in both of these states, how would you vote in just a contest involving Santorum, Romney, and Paul? And in that scenario, Santorum comes out ahead in both states. So it's very clear that Gingrich staying in the race is keeping Santorum from winning. Although we may be talking 48 hours from now, if Gingrich has a stronger day on Tuesday, that Santorum staying in the race is keeping Gingrich from winning. And I certainly agree that the longer that they're both in, the better news it is for Mitt Romney. There's just not room for two conservative candidates to be in this race and have either one of them really thrive.
And I see you threw in a question here about the scandal of the week, if you will, the question 21. Do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Rush Limbaugh? In Alabama, of course, 53% favorable, 33% unfavorable. I'm looking for Mississippi. Do you have that handy? Oh, here it is here.
51% favorable, 30% unfavorable in Mississippi. And what's interesting about Limbaugh's numbers in both of those states is that the last time we polled on Limbaugh nationally, 80% of Republicans had a favorable opinion of him, only 12% unfavorable. So to see that favorable down to 53 in Alabama, 51 in Mississippi, arguably the most conservative states in the country, makes it pretty clear that Limbaugh's image has really been hurt over the last week and a half with this controversy.
And in terms of who you polled, Tom Jensen, again, the director of public policy polling, we're talking about the poll just released by public policy polling of Alabama and Mississippi on the eve of tomorrow's primary vote down there. It looks as though the majority in both states are consider themselves evangelical Christians.
Absolutely. And just one more data point pointing to how impressive it is that Romney is so competitive in these states. You certainly wouldn't expect a Mormon to come out successfully in a state where almost 70% of Republican primary voters are evangelicals. But I think it's a sign both of the conservative split, and also that Republicans are increasingly accepting of Romney. And Romney's popularity in Mississippi, where we had polled 4 months ago, is on the rise.
But the Tea Party doesn't seem to have a lot of traction. 25% is about where it comes in, right?
Absolutely. And I think the fact that Mitt Romney is heading towards winning the nomination is a sign of waning Tea Party influence. There's no way that a Mitt Romney-style candidate could have won the Republican presidential nomination in 2010, but that Tea Party fever just isn't there the way it was a couple of years ago. I think that movement has definitely peaked and is now on a downward spiral. And we're seeing this not just in the presidential race, but in Senate primaries, gubernatorial primaries across the country. Establishment candidates are looking much better this year than they did in 2010.
So, in closing, Tom Jensen, again, the director of public policy polling, we're talking about the polls just done in Alabama and Mississippi on the eve of the primary vote. This could be a long night then, right? I mean, they're all within a point of each other, pretty much.
Absolutely. In Alabama, all three candidates within 2 points of each other. In Mississippi, all three candidates within 6 points of each other. This definitely seems like one where it's definitely not going to be a situation where the race is called with the polls closed. It could be well into the night, and we may even have to wake up on Wednesday morning and see who won these.
And then on Wednesday morning, the big argument will be Santorum will be saying, you know, I would be up there with the same delegate count, but for the fact that the vote split. The evidence is pretty overwhelming, isn't it?
Yep. Santorum will say Gingrich should drop out. Gingrich will say Santorum should drop out. Neither of them will drop out, and Mitt Romney will just be a day closer to the nomination.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tom Jensen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Jensen, who is the director of public policy polling. They have just done a poll in Mississippi and Alabama on the eve of the primary votes tomorrow. And again, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating this Thursday evening, March the 15th at 7 p.m., Buying Votes with Lawrence Lessig, the head of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University and author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. We'll be talking about alternatives to our already money-driven electoral system now overwhelmed by super PACs. Again, this Thursday, March the 15th, 7 p.m., join me. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.